Hey, Feminist Frequency listeners, we would love you to join our podcast community on Patreon. That's patreon.com/femfreak.
Like the school, right? I was asking myself, like, what school did they go to that, like, what was her name? Darla?
Yeah, Darla.
I can't remember her name. But, like, she looks like a second grader is going to school with seniors in high school.
Yes.
Like, what school in Philadelphia? Like, if this is not a private school, and even then I don't buy it, but what school is this? Welcome to Feminist Frequency Radio. This is episode 73. I'm your old electric subway wizard with the bad wig, Ebony Adams. Anita is somewhere, I think Berlin, maybe London. She's in Europe, I believe, but I know she's definitely playing around with Magic 8 Balls, so I'm handling hosting duties this week. Joining me on the Council of Eternity is fan favorite, Carolyn Pettit. Carolyn, how are you?
Hey, thrilled to be here.
This is the show that asks you to be critical of the media you love. Or alternatively, we're the feminist killjoys coming for your media, depending upon your perspective. Today, we're going to be talking about Shazam, a funny, not at all grimdark new DC superhero romp where the true power lies in recognizing your true family. After that, we'll finish the show by each sharing a little something in What's Your Freakout Deal? Now, on with the show. Time for banter.
Yeah. So, Ebony, how was your weekend?
Well, I spent time trying to do the things I should have been doing all year, i.e. collecting all of my tax receipts and documents and trying to get that malarkey done.
Ooh.
Spoiler alert, I was not successful. So I will be spending the remainder of today weeping into copious pots of coffee. And
yeah,
I guarantee you I'm going to wind up just filing an extension at the end of the night because it's a mess. And shout out to fellow, you know, freelancers, creatives, et cetera, out there. This shit is a fucking mess.
It really is. It's such an ordeal.
So not a good weekend, but, you know, whatever. What about you?
I was feeling pretty lousy on Friday, so I like slept through the entirety of Friday, which felt, you know, then I felt kind of amazing, but also then my sleep schedule was completely wrecked. So it was basically just just a weird, you know, weekend that felt like time was out of joint because like I was like more awake at night and sleeping in the day, and it just felt like a separate little experience apart from like normal everyday life. It was one of those weird weekends that doesn't feel entirely real.
In my mind, you seem like you would be a night hawk anyway. Like in an ideal world, would you be walking the main streets at night?
My natural
sitting in
tendency,
diners.
Yeah, when I don't have a job, you know, or responsibilities to get up for at a decent hour, my natural tendencies do bring me to the range of like, you know, maybe staying up till like 3-4 in the morning and then maybe waking up at like, you know, noonish would probably be my default routine if I could swing it.
Well, once I win the lottery and I start my artist compound where everybody can live rent free, you and I apparently are just going to be ships in the night because my ideal schedule is being up and at 'em by like 4 a.m. and then being done by 11.
Woo!
So you
wow.
and I can, you know, share like a hot toddy in the morning. And then, you know, you go to bed and I'm up and getting shit done. Right. So we can leave post-it notes for each other.
Yeah. Wonderful. It'll be great. I cannot imagine wanting to get up at 4 in the morning.
Well, I think there's probably, you know, we'll move on in a second, but just real quick, there's probably a craving for a certain kind of quiet and contemplative time that we both love. You with, you know, late night / early morning. Me with, you know, before dawn. Anyway.
Yeah.
Let's get
well,
into
Ebony,
some pop culture news.
Let's take a look at this week's entertainment news. So, the first full trailer and the title of episode 9 in the mainline Star Wars saga have been revealed. The title is The Rise of Skywalker. And this raises a few concerns for me because, you know, I'm someone who really valued or appreciated what Rian Johnson did in The Last Jedi of kind of setting up Rey as a descendant of, you know, her parents were, as I think Kylo Ren puts it anyway, like nobodies. They were not like significant, you know, they weren't like secretly Skywalkers or whatever. Because, you know, I mean, for one, just I'm kind of over stories in general that focus on sort of specific bloodlines as having, you know, like being tied into destiny in these significant ways, while everyone else is just kind of, you know, like a relative commoner, you know, so I'm, you know, I'm very much hoping that, because we know J.J. Abrams kind of loves his mystery boxes and everything. And I feel like what Rian Johnson did with The Last Jedi to some extent was to smash the mystery box that it kind of seemed like J.J. Abrams was constructing. I'm just really hoping that it doesn't end up being, some, you know, Rey is a Skywalker or something along those lines.
Or Kylo Ren gets a pretty unearned redemption.
because he is a Skywalker, right? But I don't want to. After Rey has been the center, really, of this story since The Force Awakens, I don't want it to swerve in the end and be like, no, really, it was secretly the white guy's, you know, story all along. Like he was the main figure and zing, ta-da, he's a Skywalker. He takes up arms against, you know, so apparently Emperor Palpatine is still in the mix in some way. We hear the menacing laugh of Ian McDiarmid. I don't know if I'm
McDiarmid.
Pronouncing.
I'm not going to lie. I did get chills when I heard that. Like I did flashback.
There's wonderful imagery in this trailer too. I mean, the wreckage of the second Death Star. I mean, there's a lot of stirring imagery. So, you know, my one other thought about the title, The Rise of Skywalker, like how I could be kind of okay with it is we know that Richard E. Grant, an actor that you and I both really enjoy, is in the film in some, as of yet, as far as I know, unknown role. You know, if Richard E. Grant plays a kind of bumbling, long-lost Skywalker cousin who fumbles his way Inspector Clouseau style into, like, foiling the enemy, I would be totally okay with that.
I didn't know that's what I wanted, but now I'm very confident that's what I want.
Yeah. All right. In other news, all right. This past week, Trump, 45, whatever. I hate even acknowledging his existence, but he has tweeted actually a few like truly alarming and in some cases horrifying and offensive videos. The first of which was just this like really hilariously shoddy, just pure propaganda campaign video, that, you know, it looked like it, you know, like I make crappy YouTube videos. Like I just, whatever, I don't know what the hell I'm doing. And so sometimes I'll just put an image like, you know, in one of my videos where I'm talking about California, I'm like, I don't know what to put here. All right, here's an image of Bob's Big Boy or whatever. Just put it in there. It's fine. And because it's something that I associate with California in certain ways. So anyway, it looked like a movie that I could make, right? But the funny part of this is that Trump, not he, but whoever put the video together, they used music. The background score was actually score that was composed for The Dark Knight Rises. And so Warner Brothers filed a copyright infringement complaint. And so for a long time, you know, Trump's tweet was just like the video player, but it said, you know, something that the line about like this media is currently unavailable due to a copyright claim, something along those, that boilerplate line, whatever it is.
Yeah.
And just like, I mean, you know, there was some kind of satisfaction in that for me, as minor a thing as it is, I have to admit. And like, I mean, as somebody like, and I'm really ambivalent about copyright law in general in a lot of cases, but still, like, I allowed myself to indulge in some laughter.
How hilariously apropos that the music was from The Dark Knight Rises.
I know.
Right? Like, you know, like, it's just so on the nose. You know, like, you got this, you know, fascistic man baby with, you know, daddy and parent issues. So good.
It's true. I mean, I remember when the Dark Knight came out, the second film in the trilogy, and a lot of people said at the time, like, well, this is basically George W. Bush Patriot Act apologia?
Apologia, yeah. Uh-huh.
Apologia, yeah, you know, like, and that reading to me was, like, I didn't want to admit it, but I totally saw that in the film. Like, I don't know how you cannot see The Dark Knight as basically, like, a right-wing film politically. So it is, I guess, somewhat, yes, appropriate, as you say, that The Dark Knight Rises was the film from which they took the music for that video. Also this week, there was a Q&A in The New Yorker with writer Bret Easton Ellis. Now, Bret Easton Ellis... Oh, my God. It's so... So, Bret Easton Ellis, you know, mainly known as a writer of fiction. He wrote the novel Less Than Zero. He wrote American Psycho, right? You know, he was very kind of big in, like, the 80s. And now he has a new nonfiction book coming out called White. And the amazing thing, this Q&A in The New Yorker is amazing because the interviewer, Isaac, and I don't know how to pronounce his last name, like Chotiner, the interviewer basically kind of makes Bret Easton Ellis repeatedly admit, just like again and again and again, that he doesn't actually... You know, the kind of core hypocrisy that he doesn't give a fuck about politics, even though his whole memoir, his whole collection of essays or whatever it is, reifying basically white supremacy and just kind of glossing over any of the impact that Trump has, you know, Trump's administration has on marginalized people. There's, you know, here's one like quick little exchange from the Q&A. Where the interviewer says to Ellis, "You are a novelist. You write about the human condition. Do you worry about the self-harm of people who see things like child separation and have no emotional response?" Ellis says, "I think I'm an absurdist. I think politics are ridiculous." Which he basically is like the running theme through this. Yeah. He just trots that out as a defense whenever he doesn't have a good answer. Like, well, I just think it's ridiculous. I just think politics are ridiculous. The interviewer says, maybe don't write a book about it. Would that be the solution? Ellis says, I think the problem is that I don't necessarily see this as interesting as fiction. And the interviewer says, yeah, I could tell. It's a really good Q&A that does not let Bret Easton Ellis off the hook for his horrible politics or for his, is guaranteed to be horrible new book, White.
This whole notion that, like, cis white dudes, where everything is a thought experiment for them, like, none of these questions that affect the lives of others carry any real weight for them. And so, you know, they adopt this or retreat into this, you know, this position of like studied indifference or kind of like, you know, faux objective wry humor, you know? And that's supposed to be that like the sort of mark of their civilization and their, you know, profound intelligence and wisdom that they're able to maintain this distance. And it's like, A, that's a false position. You are absolutely in the trenches with us. You're just on the side that perhaps you don't want to acknowledge. But also just the notion that like he's not interested in these things, but this was just something he tossed off because it was like, you know, here are my thoughts. I haven't really thought them through. And as if you read the New Yorker piece, you will see that the interviewer is able to make him sort of like, you know, say one thing, walk it back, say it again in another way. He has no idea what he's talking about. And yet this guy got a book published.
Yeah. Yeah.
On this issue. You're like, what?
I know. It's ridiculous. Yeah. It's very frustrating how that still the kind of white male, very privileged perspective can be presented as the quote unquote view from nowhere, like the objective journalistic view, when it's anything but objective. All right, finally, we're running out of time, but I want to wrap up this week's entertainment news with a new little segment I like to call "Can We Not?"
I love it already.
This past week, Julian Assange made his first public appearance in years after Ecuador revoked his political asylum. And I don't want to, you know, name specifics. I don't want to go after anyone in particular. But, you know, there was at least one tweet, quite possibly a good deal more, that took, you know, an image of Assange, who is not looking great, you know, and also took an image of perennially youthful actor Paul Rudd, and said in the tweet, basically, proof that evil ages you, Assange is 3 years younger than Paul Rudd. And, you know, this, like, Disney movie-like association of attractiveness with virtue and unattractiveness or, you know, or ugliness with evil is, like, so bogus and harmful. So yeah. Can we just not do that anymore? Like, please, just stop.
I'm right there with you. Although I have to say, some of the memes about Julian Assange coming out of the Ecuadorian embassy looking like an embittered old wizard did make me laugh. I'm not gonna lie.
No. Because a lot of that is just like personal grooming, and like he just has like let his be. Yes, absolutely.
Hey, listeners, we love that you're tuning into our show where we deliver intersectional feminist analysis of pop culture every single week. You can help us keep bringing this sharp, honest, and sometimes funny analysis to you by joining our podcast community on Patreon. In exchange for your dollars, we've got some perks like early access, weekly bonus episodes, AMAs, and an amazing community that hangs out on our private Discord server. So please consider joining us at patreon.com/femfreak.
Speaking of embittered old wizards, Ebony,
with terrible hair, let's talk Shazam. Mm-hmm. All right. So this week, Caro and I saw Shazam, the latest entry in DC's cinematic superhero pantheon. The film stars a delightful multi-ethnic cast and charts the emotional journey of the young orphan, Billy Batson, a troubled foster kid who transforms whenever he yells, Shazam! He doesn't say it like that, into a lycra-suited, golden-booted hero. As you would expect, young Billy has a hilarious time exploring his new suite of powers alongside his disabled foster brother slash superhero superfan, Freddy. After a mano-a-mano battle with the film's big bad, that's Sylvana. Sylvana? Our boy Shazam learns to accept and love his newfound family. The film is directed by Swedish director Daniel Sandberg and features Zachary Levi as Shazam, Jaimin Hansu as the original Shazam, and Mark Strong as that Sylvana. Caro, tell me your thoughts about this movie.
So I think that Shazam is a perfect film. I think that this is absolutely a perfect work of cinema. And I'll tell you what I think it's perfect for. It's perfect for, you know, if it's like 3 a.m. and you can't sleep and you're just going through the channels, flipping through the channels, looking for something to watch, but you don't want to watch something that's actually good because, you know, you don't have the attention span for it right now. You want just something, you know, it's not going to be anything lost if the way you watch it is like, it's, you know, just there to amuse you when you can't really sleep. Shazam is like the perfect film for that. It is fully disposable, forgettable, you know, largely in my mind, forgettable. But entertaining enough on its own terms in fits and starts, I guess.
Same. As a collection of scenes, mm-hmm. I was entertained. As a movie, I felt as if it was dragging, as if I wasn't having certain key questions answered, but then other questions they spent quite a bit too much time on. And yet I walked out of it thinking like, you know what? This was fine. I would have probably loved this movie if I was 8 you know? And I think there's nothing wrong with acknowledging, you know what, this, I am not the core audience for this. And there is a core audience, and their desires and likes should be respected. Without this film having to both please them and, you know, me, a snarky 87-year-old, right? So that's where I was left. I do think there were parts of the movie, including Zachary Levi as the grown-up Shazam. There were times when I was just delighted by him. I was absolutely delighted.
Yeah. I think he's great in the role of Shazam. Part of my, I mean, this is, you know, not a huge issue, but part of my, part of where the movie failed for me to some degree is that I had a lot of trouble reconciling Billy Batson and Shazam as two halves, you know, two sides of the same person, because I totally understand that young Billy Batson is sad, he's troubled, and everything, but I guess what I would have, and obviously being Shazam is a wonderful, empowering thrill, I guess I just felt like I would have liked in the scenes with Billy following his becoming Shazam, if we saw a little more of that kind of cockiness or joy that he gets from being Shazam bleed over into Billy. But Billy seems like completely unchanged when he's young Billy by his experiences as Shazam. And so it didn't work for me that there was no arc there internally for Billy as far as how he presented or, you know, his affectation within the world. And I felt like, come on, like being Shazam, that's gonna like change you to some degree, like how you act in the world.
right. Even when you're not Shazam. So just to back up a little bit, the film opens in 1974, and we are with a young boy who we learn is named Thaddeus Savannah. He's in the backseat of a car with his asshole dad and his asshole younger brother. They are traveling.
The asshole dad, by the way, played by none other than John Glover.
Glover, who always, always happy to see that guy on screen. So he is called from the car in this supernatural magic way to like this underground tunnel where he meets Jaimin Hansu as the magic electrical subway wizard who says, I'm looking for the chosen. I'm getting old. I can no longer carry this mantle of power, but the person I choose has to be pure in heart. You know, that is immediately tempted and is, you know, thrown back into the regular world. He fails the test. He's thrown back into the regular world. His reaction to that experience causes a car accident that we learn later disables his father. And so what we learn is that over the course of his adult life, he has spent all of his time obsessively searching for a way back in to retrieve that power. But this power, the source of the power that he wants is that sort of like vindictive power offered by these figures, the seven deadly sins, who the original Shazam, Jaimin Hansu, has been holding in check. Meanwhile, against him, against his power, Jaimin Hansu finally calls Billy Batson into the underground cave, and Billy Batson transforms into Shazam. So that's kind of how the film opens. That's how Billy Batson, troubled foster kid, you know, becomes the new Shazam.
Yeah, and it's not necessarily that Billy Batson is finally like the worthy candidate that he's been looking for all this time. It's that he Jaimin Hansu cannot hold out any longer, right? He's basically at the end of his rope, and he just has to give his power to somebody and hope that that person ends up being worthy. So,
exactly. And importantly, he is the last member of the Council of Eternity. So, you know, all of this weight and responsibility rests upon his aged shoulders. And that's going to come into play later on in the film.
So another reason that the film didn't quite work for me, related to what you were just saying, is that for me, there was too much time spent after Billy becomes Shazam, purely on the fun of him and Freddy learning about his powers, enjoying that. While the film seemed to almost forget about fad. And I would have liked more of a juxtaposition of the building threat of Thad, like acquiring more knowledge and more power as Shazam kind of wastes time just, you know, enjoying his powers. Because for a long, you know, the film starts by introducing Thad, but then it seems like it kind of forgets about him for a while. And so for a long time, I, as the viewer, didn't really feel like there were any stakes involved. And I feel like the film could have done a better, could have been more effective at contrasting that, so that there's a building sense of drama, even as we get to enjoy and experience, you know, Shazam and Freddy's experimentations with Shazam's powers and the fresh new thrill that comes with that.
Yeah, I think in a similar way, the sort of wide-eyed awe and gasp of shock that you get when Billy first turns into Shazam, when he yells Shazam, it's a matter of diminishing returns the more it happens in the film, such that by the end, he's flipping back and forth out of Billy into Shazam, back and forth, you know, and I started to care less and less the more it happened. In the same way, the extended kind of like what would be in another film, like training montage, where he and Freddy are exploring the limits of his powers, it just went on too long. And I think, you know, part of what I did like about this movie, I mentioned at the top that it's not at all grimdark. Like, this is a fun, you know, kind of cotton candy film. And I appreciate that. I appreciate that I could see what was going on in every scene, that it wasn't shot through like this blue light filter, you know, that the Shazam wasn't this like tortured anti-hero that I'm supposed to forgive everything of, right? So I appreciate it. Like, this film really leaned into the magic and the fun of comics and the whole ludicrous idea of a superhero.
Right.
But part of the appeal of the superhero figure is that it isn't just fun and games for them. You can maintain that fun and that sense of wonder, but while also showing us that, like, okay, if I'm suddenly gifted with these almost with these superhuman abilities, the thing that I'm going to do is not just see like how high I can bounce a ball or how I can jump or if you can set me on fire, but knowing that I exist in a world in which other superheroes exist, I'm probably going to try my hand at that kind of behavior myself, right? And so we see Shazam and Freddy like heading off a robbery at a convenience store. But then after that, we don't really get enough of that kind of behavior, that kind of like, you know, attempts at heroics, such that when Savannah does come again, I'm like, oh yeah, like Shazam is totally not ready for this. Like the film has not prepared me to believe that ultimately he's going to be able to withstand Savannah, who has been preparing for this kind of thing his whole life, essentially.
Yeah. Yeah. That's a good point. So Mark Strong plays Thad. Is he an actor that people know from something?
Mark Strong?
Yeah.
He is so great as the villain. And
yeah.
So he was in Tinker Tailor Soldier Spy, which is one of the few films in which he doesn't play like an out and out, you know, baddie. But yeah, he's always the villain. And you can see why. Like, he's so, he relishes and is so delicious as a villain. You just don't look at that. It's like Jack Nicholson. You don't look at that guy and think like, yeah, that's a middle school science teacher who, you know, really inspired me to be my best self.
Yeah.
I have to say, like, Mark Strong, great. Zachary Levi, great. The foster parents, great. Some of the other acting in this film, whole boy.
Well, I want to say, so I don't know whether to blame, how much blame to put on the actors and how much to put on the screenplay. Because, so, Freddie, for instance, I felt like every scene with Freddie, he was written like a typical kind of wisecracking sitcom teen. He never had an exchange or a line of dialogue that I found believable as something that a human being of that age would actually say. It always, like, it was so overly calibrated to be a zinger of sorts. And I dislike that kind of writing. So I kind of grew tired of his character. And I don't know, again, like certainly, you know, the writing did not do that character any favors in my mind. So I don't know how, you know, you do those lines in a way that I find acceptable, because I find the lines themselves, like, designed to be the kind of writing that is, like, you know, like, it's designed to be entertaining, but it's not designed to be at all authentic.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, that sort of character fit in perfectly with the, you know, kind of fantastical, you know, completely inauthentic setup of the film in certain scenes, like the school, right? I was asking myself, like, what school did they go to that, like, what was her name? Darla?
Yeah, Darla.
I can't remember her name. But, like, she looks like a second grader is going to school with seniors in high school.
Yes.
Like, what school in Philadelphia? Like, if this is not a private school, and even then I don't buy it, but what school is this?
Yeah, the film does not want us to look too closely into questions like that.
I want to talk a little bit more about Freddy because, so when Billy is first, you know, granted the power of Shazam, he is told that, like, to wield this power, he is going to be given, like, his ideal form, like, right? Like, the ideal form of Billy Batson is this, like, 32-year-old, you know, cis dude with huge muscles, okay? And I have a problem with the notion of the perfect body as it pertains to sort of notions of, like, you know, physical ability, you know, musculature, whatever. Like, it's going to be a problem. But I was willing to set all of that aside. But I had a creeping horror, which ultimately was borne out, that Freddie, who, you know, as I mentioned, is disabled, was going to have the opportunity to exist in his ideal body, and that it wasn't going to be his version of his ideal body, but rather the movie's version of what his ideal body would be. And that's what we get. So at the end of the film, when Shazam realizes that he needs the collective power of his foster brothers and sisters to defeat the forces of the seven deadly sins, he has them hold the magic staff, shout Shazam, and then they become their older idealized versions. And we see Freddy's cane, his armbrust, like, cast away. And now he is this tall, physically able, imposing figure. And I was just like, ugh, this sucks. You know, this sucks. The idea that, and also Pedro, who was my favorite kid in that house, is no longer fat. I'll fuck you for that too. You know?
Right. Yeah, I walked away from the film in that regard, imagining that situation were real, and if I were in it, and, you know, would my ideal body, right, be like a cis woman? And what would that mean? And I think that there's a sense in, I think it, you know, if I'm being entirely honest with myself, the answer might be yes. But if that were going to be the topic of a work of, you know, a film or, you know, a comic book or whatever, that would have to be explored really deeply for all of the complexities that in and of itself kind of raises, about, you know, my own feelings about myself, the prioritizing of cisness over transness, all of those things, right? But this film doesn't do any of that work at all. It just bam, these are their idealized bodies. The fat one is no longer fat. The disabled one is no longer disabled. Voila.
Exactly. Like, it would be one thing if the film suggested that this is your internal version of your idealized self, because then it would make sense to me that, you know, a 15-year-old kid might be working through some issues about his identity as a disabled person. And so whether I agree with it or not is immaterial. If his version of himself at that moment in time is of a person without a disability, okay. But it's the movie suggests that there is some objective idealized version of these people. And so it has been imposed from without. And that's what I took issue with. Because if we're talking about superheroes, people who can literally hold up a city bus, you know, full of people by the power of their musculature, that is so far out of the realm of possibility. It does not matter if you have muscles, you know, you could be fat and still do that if you're a superhero. You could be disabled and still do that if you're a superhero. You know, like, the quality of your muscles has nothing to do with it. Whether you're 6'4" or 5'2" has nothing to do with it. Whether you're cis or trans has nothing to do with it. And so, like, the fact that, you know, we get these, you know, hot, you know, attractive, like, you know, conventionally attractive, you know, cis people as the idealized version of these people. Like, I'm not gonna lie, it was very cute when, God, I can't believe I don't remember her name, the little girl, that when she, you know, transforms and she's like the Megan Good version of her character, but she's still very girly inside, you know, and she talks to Santa. It was very cute, but I was put off by Freddie and by Pedro.
I mean, there is a scene where Freddie voices some of what he feels on a daily basis. He starts talking about how he feels, you know, invisible, and he's always trying to get people to notice him. And I guess I feel like if the film had dug into that a little more, because again, to go to my own hypothetical of if that were me, right? If I did want to be cis in that situation, it's not because I inherently believe that cis is superior to trans at all, but it's because part of me longs to have cis privilege. It's because of how I'm viewed and treated by other people, the way that my visible transness often comes between me and people seeing me as the person that I fundamentally believe I am, the way that I'm constantly still misgendered and things like that. Like, I would love to cast all that off and be perceived in the world as the person that I am. And so I understand Freddie maybe not wanting anymore the burden, the social burden, the cultural burdens that come with his disability. But yes, as you say, again, it is just the film saying this is the idealized, this is objectively like the idealized version of your body. And that's a problem.
Can we talk about found families in this film? And this is one of the things that is so great about the Marvel Extended Universe, about, you know, comics in general, about the fantastic and speculative fiction, is the way in which found family is so, you know, elemental to the ways that, like, people find their power and find ways of existing in the world and find strength. I was so in love with the foster parents in this movie and the group home that they set up. And I just thought, God, how wonderful is it that they build this, like, affirmative family based upon the experiences that they've had? They're both former foster parents themselves. And, you know, the movie is not shy about saying that these people themselves are superheroes. Like, there's the beat up old van that they drive around has a bumper sticker that says, "I'm a foster mother. What's your superpower?" You know? And I absolutely loved the way that works.
I agree completely. I mean, personally, I did not have a great experience with my birth family growing up, and there are a lot of media, you know, narratives that basically reinforce the idea of family first, like family comes first no matter what, and those narratives don't really work for me, because there were times where I had to kind of put my own survival as an individual first, and And it was just irreconcilable with continuing to be invested in parts of my family. So anytime a film says that family is not it's not necessarily the family you're born into, it's, you know, the people that you love, it, found families are every bit as valid as any other kind of family. I really appreciate that. And I certainly, like, we very rarely see positive representations of foster families, or the experiences of people, of young people in that system. So that was definitely a very, very heartwarming. And I was, yes, I love that aspect of this film.
Yeah. And it's, you know, it's such a great, there's such a great contrast set up between Thaddeus Savona's family. His father is emotionally abusive and really setting him up for a lifetime of embracing a very toxic form of masculinity, not asking for help from others, you know, putting away childish things, not, you know, having any kind of juvenile desires, being, you know, strong and distant, right? And Billy's own experience being left at a fairground as a child and never being sought out by his mother. I love that this film, which again is for children, you know, has this very important message that sometimes the people who are meant to take care of you and love you, unfortunately, they don't have your best interests at heart, you know, but you can find people who will offer that, who will love you and affirm you, and that you can love and affirm, like that's out there. I think that's such a crucial, important message for kids, because the tendency is for children to believe like there's something wrong with me. If there's something wrong with my family, it's because there's something wrong with me and the way that I'm behaving, and I'm making my parents behave this way, or I've caused this problem in my family. And this film offers a very useful counterpoint to that, to say, no, you know, this is sometimes our parents or our guardians, they aren't what we need, you know, but there are people out there, and you can find them, and you will find them.
Finally, I'd like to just briefly talk about Jaimin Honshu in this film. And like, because when he appeared, I just had the thought, because he is decked out in like full on wizard regalia. Like and I just thought, like, I don't think I've ever seen a black man, a black character in like as a Gandalf style, you know, wizard figure. It's like the stereotypical Merlin Gandalf style wizard, but here he is, and that's pretty cool.
It absolutely is. I wish they had spent some Gandalf money on that wig, because that shit was tragic. But no, I love it too. There has been blessed little space for people of color. Well, basically anyone who's not a cis white dude or a cis white woman, to space for them in like the fantastic universe, no matter what universe that happens to be. So I loved that he was the Shazam, the original, well, maybe not the original, but the current version of Shazam before Billy Batson takes over. And I mean, I've loved Jaimin Honshu since like forever, but also a big fan. He was so great as Papa Midnight in Constantine. Constantine, a film that is way, way underrated.
Oh, God.
Go watch it.
I just, oh God, every shot of Keanu Reeves smoking a cigarette in that movie is just like, oh, it's amazing.
Tilda Swinton in a suit? Are you kidding me?
Yeah,
why don't you own this movie, people?
Yeah, it's, yes, Constantine is very, very good.
Yeah. Well, so, okay, final thoughts on Shazam. As Caro said, it is perfect for what it is. It is ultimately a confection that for, I think, your children will love. You don't have to be a child to love it, but nor should you feel as if, you know, if it's just meh for you, or if it's something you'll watch as you're taking a nap on a Sunday or getting ready to take a nap on a Sunday, it's perfect for that.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what we got for you, folks. Carolyn,
yo,
let's go into what's your deal? What's your deal?
What's your deal?
What's your deal? What's your deal? What is your deal? That's
yo,
right, folks. If I'm sitting in the captain's chair, the name of the segment is what's your deal?
Yo.
Anita can't do nothing about it. Deal with it, Anita. Carolyn, what's your deal?
So my deal this week is a film. Oh, God, I love this film so much. So this the film came out in 2017 or 2018 that I slept on for a while, despite hearing from many people that it was a really wonderful little gem of a film. And boy, it truly is. The film I'm talking about is called Columbus.
Mm.
And this film,
it's on Hulu, right?
I believe so, yes.
With John Cho?
Yes, with John Cho. So this film is set, I assumed originally that it was like Columbus, Ohio, but it's actually Columbus, Indiana, which is a small-ish town, but is significant for its architecture. A lot of very, you know, significant buildings were built there in, I think, the 1950s, 60s. And so it remains something of a place that people who are deeply interested in architecture will travel to. So in this film, so John Cho plays a man who is estranged from his father, and his father is an architecture expert who is in Columbus to give a lecture about architecture when he falls into a coma. And, of course, John Cho's character, Jin, lives in South Korea. He works as a translator, but, of course, he comes to Columbus because of his ailing father. And in Columbus, he strikes up an unlikely, you know, friendship with this young woman played by an actor named Haley Lou Richardson, who I wasn't very familiar with before this, although she's been in a number of things, but she is outstanding as well. And the film, it is, you know, I don't know how much you or Anita would respond to it, because it is it is what I think of as a quintessential Caro film, and it might be too quiet, too gentle, it might be too nothing really happens for at least, I don't know, but for me, I mean, the direction in this film, the images in it, which really make fantastic use of the fascinating architecture in Columbus. The images in this film are just so carefully constructed. It is a film that is very, very gentle on the surface. But that very careful, gentle construction on the surface does, it allows us in some ways to see the deeply felt emotions underneath the placid surface. And maybe a week after watching it, I'm still so affected by so many of the images in this film. I'm affected by just John Cho's presence and performance and the relationship that these two characters develop. I think this film is really wonderful. I mean, it's my favorite film that I've seen in some time. I if you like John Cho at all, if you like other movies that I would call Caro movies, you probably know the type by now. If you're a regular listener, they're character driven. They're maybe kind of intimate. They're maybe are a little on their art house to some degree. If you
probably
respond, probably no one has a gun. Yes. If all that, you know, is stuff that you respond to as well, please check out Columbus. It's available on a number of, you can rent it on a number of online services.
Awesome. I'm going to check that out. I do enjoy the occasional Caro film.
Yes, I know.
I won't lie. Sometimes I do get in my feelings. I have to have a runtime, rundown talk with myself, but I'm going to check it out. My deal this week is Unicorn Store. Netflix film directed by Brie Larson, starring Brie Larson, Samuel L. Jackson, Bradley Whitford, Joan Cusack, and Mamadou Atiye. I need to check pronunciations before I come on the show. At any rate, so the film is quite, it's like 90 minutes, but it's just this sweet, funny, very touching and real, you know, rumination on growing up, growing older, finding yourself, staying true to yourself. Brie Larson plays a character who is an artist, and whose entire, you know, like artistic style and her entire life is sort of this pastel drenched, glitter soaked, you know, unicorn obsessed, you know, embrace of what we would consider like the girly or the feminine or the childish, and the ways in which the world at large, you know, tries to make her something different, and which she initially accedes to, but then, you know, the ways that she finds to hold on to that magic, it's delightful. It was really delightful.
Is this something that she and Samuel L. Jackson just like did to kill time between takes on Captain Marvel?
Absolutely convinced that that is the case. That like they just became such good friends. And she was like, I'm working on this thing. Would you be in it? And he was like, I will do this. I will do carpool karaoke with you. I will do any number of Netflix originals with you. And we are all the richer for it. The set design is amazing, particularly the costuming of both Brie Larson's character and Samuel L. Jackson's character. He looks like an alternate universe, and his like, you know, bright jewel tone or pastel suits, you know, what's the word? Not glitter, but, you know, like sequins in his hair. Like he looks like an alternate universe of the character from Unbreakable.
Oh yeah.
What was his name? Mr. Glass. He looks like an alternate version of his. Like, yeah, I think he might be wearing the same wig. Anyways, it's 90 minutes. It's 90 minutes that you will find well spent. And I was particularly impressed with the actor who plays Virgil, the guy that Brie Larson's character finds in a hardware store and enlists to help her build a unicorn, a stable for her unicorn. This actor, this young Black actor, it is so rare that people of color, particularly men of color, get the opportunity to play these kinds of wry, quiet, soft roles. We have much more use for men of color, particularly Black men of in film and TV, when there is some edge to them, when there is some quality of menace to them, some element even of cool to them, right? We feed off proximity to those qualities. It is very rare that you get a character like Virgil in this movie that gets that is played by a Black actor, and I just loved it. I mean, the dude's reaction shots are a work of art. So check out Unicorn Store. It's on Netflix. You have 90 minutes. This week, we also have a listener freakout from Golden Voice listener Jonathan about a production of Richard II at England's Globe Theatre. It's directed by and features a cast of all women of color. So, Jonathan, tell us about it.
Hi, Anita, Rebody, and Carolyn. I'm freaking out about the new all women of color production of Shakespeare's Richard II at the Globe Theatre in London. It's co-directed by Lynette Linton and Adjoa Ando, and Adjoa Ando also plays King Richard. The staging is thick, atmospheric, there's live music, candlelight, there's visually arresting costume and set design inspired by the cast members' heritage. Adjoa Ando, who plays Richard, is phenomenal. She is one of the most exciting British actors working today. But what's striking is that it also seems really timely. Richard II is a play about a divided England, and it asks what does it mean to be English and who owns the idea of England. There were laughs and applause when the dying John of Gaunt said, "That England that was once to conquer others hath made a shameful conquest of itself," and that could have been written last week as a satire about Brexit. Richard II is on until the 21st of April at the Sam Wanamaker Playhouse in London. If you can, go and see it. These women will blow your socks off.
thanks so much, Jonathan. That was awesome. Submit your own freak out and it might make it on the show. Just head over to femfreak.com/freakout. All right. You made it. You made it to the end of a show with just Ebony and Caro.
Woo!
You can catch us back here every single Wednesday. Stay tuned for the freaking after party, which is only available to backers of this podcast, which you can be, baby. Just head over to patreon.com/femfreak. And if you are enjoying the show, which you know you are, quit playing. Please rate and review us on iTunes and tell your friends too. Tell your found family. Tell the people with you at the group home. Tell everybody. You can check out all of our work and our other podcasts at feministfrequency.com. Be sure to follow us on Twitter at FemFreak to stay up to date on all of the news. Carolyn, where can people find you on Twitter?
People can find me at Carolyn Michelle. They can find our fearless leader, Anita, at Anita Sarkeesian.
And you can find me at Jaimin Hansu's Dollar Store Wig. Our producer is Phil Circus, who also composed our theme music and who has the best dog. Technical support by Sarah Norales, production assistance by Taylor Simmons, art by Jamie Varon. We'll see you next week.
Later.